This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor of history at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and I'm your host for today's episode. I'm pleased to welcome Patrick Spiro to the podcast. Dr. Spiro is the director and librarian of the American Philosophical Society's Library and Museum in Philadelphia, and we'll be discussing his new book, Frontier Rebels, The Fight for Independence in the American West, 1765 to 1776, which came out with Norton in 2018. Welcome to the New Books Network, Patrick.
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm thrilled to talk about the book.
Let's begin, as we always do on this show, by just hearing a little bit about you, about your background, and about how you became interested in history.
It's a great question, and I could probably talk for far too long about my own career journey and personal path to becoming a historian and now the librarian of the American Philosophical Society. I'll just say briefly that I think an interest in history really was sparked growing up in Massachusetts and being surrounded by all these incredible historic sites and hearing about these stories. And then as I kind of developed academically, when I went to undergraduate, I majored in history. And there I just was thinking I was going to become a lawyer or I was going to go into business, but I really liked history. So why not major in something you liked? And it was as I learned what a historian actually does, that I realized that I was just captivated by the idea that history wasn't just about knowing stories or remembering names and dates. But as a historian, you are kind of an active participant in trying to interpret and understand the past and to debate and discuss these ideas with your colleagues and peers. And really, during a research project on the Paxton Boys Rebellion, which was the basis for my first book, Frontier Country, I really realized that this is what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And my advisor at the time at James Madison University told me that, you know, you can go on to graduate school, which was not something I'd ever considered when I first stepped on campus. But I then pursued my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, where I took that interest in the Paxton Boys Rebellion, which happened in Western Pennsylvania in 1763 and 64, and developed that into a much larger study on the expansion of Pennsylvania from its very inception in the 17th century all the way to the end of the 18th century. That became the subject of my first book. I had the great fortune of teaching at Williams College for a few years. And then I had the great fortune of being asked to be the librarian of the American Philosophical Society, which, if your readers aren't familiar with, the APS is the nation's oldest learned society. It was founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1743. And one of the things that it has is this incredible research library. We have over 13 million pages of manuscripts, over 300,000 books. We have the papers of Lewis and Clark. We have the expedition journals of Zebulon Pike and William Dunbar, and a whole range of other incredible collections. Our core areas are early American history, Native American and indigenous cultures, and the history of science, I like to say, from Newton and NASA. And within that, the early American collection is just a really rich collection on the history of the West in America, especially scientific expeditions.
Yeah, and I can say, as someone that's done research at the APS, it really is a pretty magnificent institution that I can't recommend it enough, even just to stop by and visit if you're in Philadelphia at all. So it sounds like you've had an abiding interest in the history of the early American West for some time, but can you tell us the story about how you came to write this book in particular on the early American West and the Pennsylvania frontier during the lead up to the American Revolution?
Sure. I never would have thought that I would write so many books and on the West. I grew up, as I said, in Massachusetts, close to the ocean. I had dreams of somehow finding a career which I could be close to and involved, if not on the ocean itself. But it really was that story of the Paxton Boys Rebellion, which happened in Western Pennsylvania in 1763. It was something I'd never heard of before, perhaps growing up as I did in Massachusetts and on the water. The idea of the frontier and Pennsylvania's role in the revolution were all kind of new to me. And so I worked on that first book. And it was during that book that I came across another rebellion, which is the subject of Frontier Rebels. And that's the Black Boys Rebellion, which happened in 1765, the same year as the Stamp Act. And one of my main questions has always been, how can we understand the coming of the American Revolution in the West? I feel like we, having grown up outside of Boston, you know, I know about the Sons of Liberty. We know about the Stamp Act Rebellion. We know about the Boston Massacre. We know about the Tea Party. We know how many of these events, you know, help unite urban centers, whether it's in New York City or Philadelphia or Charleston. And so I've always been interested, since I kind of began this journey as a historian, in what was happening outside of these urban seaports. How did the West and the East come together? How did the West experience what we call the imperial crisis that led up to the American Revolution? And during that research for my first book, the Black Boys were kind of a small piece of this much larger study. But I realized then that the Black Boys told an incredible story that helps understand the imperial crisis that the British Empire was facing, the imperial crisis as experienced by colonists, especially those living on what they called the frontier, and by indigenous peoples who were trying to confront both this new enlarged British Empire in the wake of the Seven Years' War, and as they were trying to fend off the encroachments of colonists on the frontier. And so this one story encapsulated so much, and I realized I couldn't do it justice in this first book, and that the only way to really do it justice was to just tell the story as a standalone project. And so that's the origins of Frontier Rebels.
So let's get into the book a little bit, and maybe we can begin by just setting the scene here. So tell us about where is the West in this book? What is the British Western frontier in the middle decades of the 18th century look like? Who lives there and what are their lives like? What's the context for this story?
Yeah, when I taught at Williams, I would teach a course on the early American frontier, and I was always surprised by how many of the students were coming from California or Utah, Colorado, because they were thinking that the early American frontier was going to deal with where they grew up. And that was a really interesting experience for me, because I had to talk to them about how Pittsburgh is the frontier that we're going to be talking about in this course. In the mid-18th century, people would describe Pittsburgh, at least in the mid-Atlantic, as the frontier. You might think of Western Virginia. That's the frontier regions for many folks. What is life like on that frontier? I can talk about the Pennsylvania frontier probably the best. And I really think it's an incredibly diverse community, probably more diverse than people realize. I just read an article that's forthcoming in Pennsylvania History. It's by an archaeologist who has uncovered at a fort that they were doing a dig at, some Islamic medallions that were likely worn by an enslaved person at this fort sometime in the mid-18th century. So there you have folks from Scots-Irish, you have Germans, you have English, you have Quakers, you have a whole range of religious denominations living on the frontiers. And then, of course, you have a whole range of Native American communities and groups. Many different Native nations are living alongside, these colonists. And so one of my main characters in my book is somebody named James Smith. And I'm nearly certain that Smith was, fluent in English, in German, and at least one Native American language. So you can just imagine how people, this fluidity that existed on the frontiers at that time.
You begin the book also with a list of characters that are going to shape the story here. This is a very personality-driven story, and I found this list very helpful. We don't really have time to go over each and every character that you list here, but maybe we can talk about four of the main characters. George Crowan, or George Croghan, Thomas Gage, James Smith, and Pontiac. Can you tell us kind of a brief thumbnail sketch of each of those people and why they matter to the story you're telling?
Sure, those are the key characters, Stephen, and it's great that you highlighted those, because what my book hopes to do is to try and tell the imperial crisis as this conflict between three different perspectives. One is the perspective of the British Empire. The other is the perspective of the colonists. And the third is the perspective of Native peoples who are living, in the greater Ohio River Valley. And each one of these kind of embodies one aspect of that. You have Thomas Gage, who is tasked with kind of overseeing the transition from war to peace. After the Seven Years' War, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, the French relinquished claims to all the land east of the Mississippi River that became ostensibly the territory of the British Empire. And Gage, one of the things the British Empire really confronted also in the wake of this war is an incredible amount of debt. And Gage's, kind of charge was from his superiors in London was, we cannot afford another war on our frontiers. We need to reduce costs. We need to open the road to Native communities so that the raw materials in the interior can be integrated into the British Empire's kind of mercantile vision. And so Gage is tasked with that. Pontiac, on the other hand, is a Native leader in Ottawa who's, among many others, trying to deal with this newly enlarged British Empire, having displaced their traditional allies, the French. They are very nervous about the intentions of the British Empire. They fear that they're going to be subjugated by this empire. They feel that they're going to lose their sovereignty. And some of the things that Gage and his predecessor, Amherst, did, cutting back on ceremonial treaties, manning forts in the interior. All these things sent signals to Native peoples who were nervous about the British Empire that the empire's intentions were, in fact, to subjugate and displace them. And so Pontiac and a group of other Native allies kind of launched an offensive to assert their sovereignty and autonomy from the British Empire in 1763. So this is exactly what Gage had been hoping to avoid. And then there's George Croghan, who is in 1765 tasked with trying to enact a temporary truce between Pontiac and his allies in the British Empire. And his orders are to go out to Fort Pitt with a pack train of goods to initiate an initial alliance with the Delaware and perhaps the Shawnees to then travel down the Ohio River in search of Pontiac, and to come to some temporary terms with Pontiac to reestablish and to show the sincerity of the British Empire that they desire peace, and to set the groundwork for Pontiac to eventually travel to Sir William Johnson outside Albany and enact a more formal peace ceremony. And then there's James Smith, who is the leader of the Black Boys. And Smith has a very remarkable life history that I probably can't give justice to right now. But Smith was born on the frontiers of Pennsylvania. And during the Seven Years' War, he's captured by a Native American war party and adopted into a Mohawk community and spends a large part of the Seven Years' War actually traveling within Native communities as a member of their community. And then in 1760 or 1761, he's eventually, as part of a prisoner exchange, sent back to his community in Pennsylvania. And so in 1765, as George Croghan is heading west, James Smith mobilizes a group of his neighbors to stop Smith's peace pack train of goods that are meant to help cement a peace with Native communities. And that really is the spark of the rebellion that I talk about. They destroy this enormous pack train of goods. It creates this crisis for Thomas Gage and others trying to manage the empire. It really puts at risk Croghan's peace mission. And it really, to my mind, helps encapsulate and crystallize what the imperial crisis is going to mean for colonists living on the West, in the West.
Well, let's go over that story a little bit. And it's a story that you tell remarkably well in this book. As I was saying before the interview started, that the writing of this book really flies off the page. You tell these stories very well. And I'm thinking that maybe we can just kind of go step by step and talk about how this mission that you describe Croghan going on, how this erupts into this larger crisis. So let's begin with the mission itself. Where is George Croghan going? What is his goal? And what is he bringing with him in particular? Because really, it's kind of the contents of this pack train that really sparks a lot of the problems that would arise later on.
Yeah. So Croghan is, Gage provides Croghan with some funds to acquire goods. He doesn't specify what goods Croghan can purchase, but Croghan then kind of goes outside of his orders, exceeds his orders, if you will, and partners with a Philadelphia merchant firm to buy an enormous amount of goods. We don't precisely know how much money he ended up spending for goods, but it was certainly probably close to 15 to 20,000 British pounds worth of material. So maybe 10 times what Gage had said. And he ends up buying all sorts of different things. He buys so many white shirts that the city of Philadelphia purportedly runs out of shirts for a period of time, and Croghan has to commission a group of women to hand sew shirts. There's, I think, 5,700 white shirts is one estimate for how much clothing he was shipping west. There's also, and this is where the real controversy comes in, there's also gunpowder that is being shipped west, along with some alcohol. And to me, that shipment of ammunition really encapsulates the crisis of the imperial crisis. And the reason why is Croghan, when he's going to defend himself, you know, will say that, you know, when peace treaties are enacted, there's a ceremonial exchange of goods to show symbolically the new alliances being forged, you know, around these treaty fires. And so, you know, hypothetically, it would be, you know, Native community, Native leaders would be providing with furs to, say, the diplomat, in this case, George Croghan. And then Croghan, on his part, would ceremonially give arms and ammunition, something that Native peoples really desired, just like the British desired the raw materials of fur. And the idea was to show that they are now friends who trust each other. And so ammunition to Croghan was a necessary part of diplomacy. Now, the problem happens for those who are living on the frontiers, people like James Smith, who had been living really on the front lines of what was almost a decade-long war, first with the Seven Years' War and then with Pontiac's War. They really were communities, civilian communities, who had become highly militarized and lived in fear of a future war. And so to them, the idea that ammunition could be exchanged with these communities, these native groups who they had just been fighting against, to them was an anathema. They could not accept that. And so as Croghan's pack train is heading west, it meets greater and greater resistance, ultimately culminating with a series of attacks that essentially destroy a large portion of that pack train.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny reading this book as someone who has lived in both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and done the drive across I-76 many, many, many times in my life, seeing all the various exits on that highway that I recognize popping up again and again, like Carlisle and Sidling Hill, all these places that I recognize from my own drives are play really crucial roles in here. And Sidling Hill, if I remember correctly, is actually the site where this crisis is kind of triggered when the Black Boys stop Croghan's caravan and destroy those goods. And maybe we can spend a minute talking more about the Black Boys, because we talked about James Smith, but it's a whole group of people. Can you talk a little bit more about who these people are, why they call themselves the Black Boys, and sort of what their mission is, what their goal is?
Yeah, so Sidling Hill, and what was remarkable to me is I ended up traveling out to this area. I always feel like you have to see what you're writing about and try and know it. And I met a lot of people in the community, and there's even a movement within the community to really mark Sidling Hill and the towns that surround it as the start of the American Revolution. And the reason why is because as Croghan's pack train is heading further and further west, there's greater and greater resistance. And when they stop outside of the town that is today Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, they're really confronted by a group of colonists who draw their arms, tell them to stop. They can't go any further. And eventually, after night, that pack train heads further west and it gets close to what is today McConnellsburg, which sits at the foot of Sidling Hill. And if you travel west to Pittsburgh, Sidling Hill is a major exit on the highway. And so the reason this is so such a pressure point for colonists is if they make it past Sidling Hill, there really are no more communities till Pittsburgh. There are some forts, but there really aren't any colonial settlements. And so if this pack train is able to make it past Sidling Hill, they're going to be able to make it all the way to Pittsburgh. And so a group of men led by James Smith, calling themselves the Black Boys, attack that pack train of goods in the early morning hours and destroy, an enormous amount of it. And they're called the Black Boys because they are dressed as Native Americans. They adopt Native American tactics that James Smith said he learned while he was adopted into a Mohawk community during the Seven Years' War. And they blacken their faces to disguise who they are. And what ends up happening is after they destroy that initial pack train of goods, the commandant of Fort Loudoun sees this as just in the same way that, British troops in the urban seaports see colonial resistance movements as unlawful and outside the bounds of propriety. The commandant of Fort Loudoun reacts the same way, and he sends out a regiment into these colonial settlements searching for members of the Black Boys. And They end up arresting two men, if I remember correctly, and seizing a series of guns and other property and bringing them back to Fort Loudoun. And so this only escalates the situation more, where the Black Boys now feel as if the British Army has invaded into civilian law, you know, searching and seizing men. That's something that sheriffs or justice of the peace should do, not the British military. The British military is supposed to defend them, not become a policing force. And so in the days that follow, the Black Boys, which started as this relatively small band that attacked this pack train of goods at Sidling Hill, mushrooms into hundreds of men, all of whom are now supporting James Smith. And they eventually lay siege to Fort Loudoun to try and free their fellow colonists who are held there and to seize back the guns. And after a siege of, I think, 2 days, the commandant of Fort Loudoun releases the prisoners but continues to hold on to the guns. And then, and this is to me what really makes the Black Boys more than just some sort of riot. In the days that follow, the Black Boys become a frontier-wide movement in which there's from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, all the way to Fort Loudoun. So more than 100 miles, probably close to 200 miles on all the roads, there are men who call themselves Black Boys. And if you're traveling on those roads, you're liable to search to make sure you're not carrying any contraband or anything that they believe should not be traded with Native peoples. And they even start handing out passports. So they're really starting to assert this extra legal official quasi-government function. And when you think about that in conversation with what we know about was happening in the urban seaports with the Sons of Liberty and the Committees of Correspondence, you actually see something happening in parallel. Now, they're happening for very different reasons, but the process that's leading towards revolution, I think, has some really interesting parallels in these two cases.
I still want to ask this question of why, though. So you have this attack on Croghan's convoy, which triggers this larger crisis. And on the one hand, you know, you talk about Governor John Penn, who's the governor of the colony of Pennsylvania, and he seems kind of ill-equipped to handle this crisis. But I still think it's worth getting a little bit more into why this spirals so incredibly. How do each of the levels of governance react to this rebellion? And then how do the rebels themselves kind of react in kind? Because you have this kind of action and reaction process that kind of brings things out of control.
Yeah. So to get at the core of the why is something that it really is a thesis I started to develop in my first book, Frontier Country, and I think really comes to full fruition in Frontier Rebels. And that's the sense that there is a great divide over what the future of the West is going to look like. For those that are managing the British Empire, you know, they draw a proclamation line in 1763. The king says colonial settlement shall not go past the Appalachian Mountains. They do so because they don't think they can manage such an enlarged empire. They can't afford it. They're worried about colonists getting too far from the seaports and therefore becoming more independent-minded. And they're worried about Indian wars. And they really want to have what they call and what Native peoples call an open road between what's increasingly called Indian country, which is the Ohio and the Illinois regions, and the colonists to the east. Now, for the colonists, what I have argued is that over the course of the Seven Years' War, they developed a much different view of the West and of Native peoples, where those managing the British Empire can see a way in which Native nations can be allies, trading partners. Colonists begin to see Native peoples through very racialized lens as enemies, as inherent enemies that they can never trust. And so that's where you begin to see this divide developing between these three very different constituents. And in so many ways, that ammunition represents this divide over what the future of Indian relations are going to look like in the British Empire, over what the future of even the West might look like in the British Empire. To colonists, the idea that ammunition could be exchanged with Native peoples, they can't imagine that because they have begun to see Native peoples as they increasingly say, just describe them as Indians, as one whole, one group that are inherently enemies and future enemies. Where the British Empire is able to see as Benjamin Franklin himself articulates in some of his pamphlets, you know, that there are different native nations. You can have alliances with some, you can have alliances even with all, but that they are not one coherent people. They are people that can be, you know, allies and even integrated into the British Empire. And so when you get at the why, I think that's the why the rebellion, the Black Boys kind of formed. In terms of your question about governance, I mean, this raises, the Black Boys raise so many issues about governing in the British Empire. It exposes weaknesses within the British Empire's kind of structure. There are so many people at the time that are talking about the need to reform the British Empire, especially as it becomes larger. And the Black Boys really get at the core of some of these issues. The first one of the key unstated issues is who actually has authority, you know, on the frontiers. Is it the British Army in these forts? Is it the colonial government with the justices of the peace, with the sheriff, with the governor, as you mentioned? Or is it the Black Boys themselves who are trying to take authority and saying that, you know, neither the British Empire nor the colonial government actually adequately represents them? And so you have this great contest over governance that is really coming to the fore during this clash.
And then by the time we get to the late 1760s, you start to see the British government begin to undertake reforms. And among those reforms is dismantling forts throughout this frontier region, which on the one hand seems like a victory for the people dwelling on the frontiers. They were being granted seemingly more independence. The British army is, again, seemingly withdrawing. And yet they interpret this action and these reforms generally very differently as another step toward British imperial tyranny. So why is that? How is the dismantling of these forts and these larger reforms, how is this kind of... How does it become connected with this wider colonial critique of imperial governance?
Yeah, no, that's that really gets at kind of the heart of you know, there's so many interesting contradictions, if you will, of the Black Boys. On the one hand, they have an incredible distrust of their colonial government to the east. They feel the east is elite. It is represents the wealthy merchants. It's disconnected from their needs. They say the same thing about the British Empire. But at the same time, they're almost always asking for more support, more government support. And this is one of the contradictions that I think really comes out in the Black Boys' rebellion. And so they very much see, on the one hand, the dismantling of Fort Loudoun and the other forts close to them as something of a victory. On the other hand, when Fort Pitt is eventually dismantled in the early 1770s, they see this as the British Empire turning their back on colonists. You know, the fundamental, and this I think gets at what the frontier means in the 18th century, and this has been one of my main arguments in both of my books, is that in the 18th century, the frontier had a very concrete meaning, and it was the site of invasion. There's all this political theory. If you read the pamphlets about, you know, the political body and how the various constituent parts are related to each other, the idea is that the frontiers are the limbs of the political body, and they provide defense to protect the body as a whole, but they also require support. And so what I've argued is the frontier is the site in which government is either formed or lost. People on the frontier... And Franklin has a great line about this that I'll paraphrase. The people that live on the frontier expect defensive support from the government in exchange for which they provide their allegiance and obedience to government. And so what you see happening, and what I argue, is that the imperial crisis really breaks down that bond between the governed and their government. They see that their government is not providing the support they expect. Therefore, they are rebelling against it. And this starts on the frontier with people like the Black Boys. And in my earlier work, I talk about the Paxton Boys Rebellion. But pretty soon, there are arguments you begin to see coming in other pamphlets, so that you have Franklin and Jefferson and others writing about how the king has really removed his, by abandoning these forts, abandoning the frontiers, the king has really, failed to do his duty to his subjects, and therefore they have the right to rebel and declare themselves independent.
So, in sum, kind of zooming out a little bit, what role does the West play in the approach of the American Revolution? And then once the Revolution and the Revolutionary War begins, what role does the region play? And in particular, what role do the people that we've discussed here play in the course of events?
Yeah, so this is something I've thought a lot about. It. What's interesting to me is that I absolutely believe there was an imperial crisis on the West, in the West. I think it was different in different places. This book is looking at, you know, what I think was the hot zone of the British Empire's West at the time. But there were similar crises happening in North Carolina, something called the Regulator Movement, South Carolina, another movement also called the Regulator Movement, but separate from the one in North Carolina. And then in New England, you have a series of kind of border conflicts between say New Hampshire and New York or Massachusetts and New York. And there's really an incredible amount of disorder in the West. It's really shows the British Empire has been unable to adapt, has been unable to establish its authority on its very fringes, which is where I think the essence of whether or not an empire can rise or fall is how much authority it has is on these very fringes of settlement. And so I think the West has an important imperial crisis. It shows the weakness of the British Empire. And for the coming of independence in particular, the issues that the Black Boys were talking about were disconnected or separate from those in the East. When I started all my research, I wanted to know how did people on the frontiers react to the Stamp Act or the Townsend duties or the word of the Boston Massacre. And what I found is there's virtually zero discussion of these events on the frontiers, at least in Pennsylvania. They're focused much more on Indian relations, on the military, on their relationships to the Eastern government where they see themselves unrepresented. And so but what this leads to is even if the cause is different, in 1776, there is a similar conclusion between East and West, and that is that the only people who they can trust to govern are themselves, and that's where you see a general sense that the king and the British Empire is inadequate to managing them, and that the only people that they can trust are themselves, and that leads to this marriage of East and West during the American Revolution. And then when you look out further, I think this is a very brief moment of conjunction between East and West, because so much of American history going forward is this ongoing divide between East and West. So they come together in 1776, but I think that's only a temporary thing. And if you look at the Whiskey Rebellion and all the other events that have happened, in this, between the East and West, it continues through the 19th century. In terms of the Black Boys themselves, many of them, James Smith kind of embodies this, where Smith is actually eventually elected to the revolutionary government of Pennsylvania. He helps write their constitution, which is one of the most radically democratic of all the constitutions written during the American Revolution. It gives equal representation to the frontier counties, the thing that they've been asking and begging for beforehand. And then eventually he joins the Continental Army. He serves under Washington for a period of time, but he's frustrated with this style of warfare. And so he ends up returning to his community. At this point, he's living close to Pittsburgh, and he mobilizes again his own militia in order to, fight a frontier war. And then Smith continues to go on, actually, and he moves to Kentucky and serves in its earliest legislature. So in so many ways, I think Smith embodies what I call the frontier revolution, where one of the things that, the colonists were so frustrated with was the sense that the British Empire was trying to hem them in to the East. And so what do you see after the American Revolution? I think the most radical area of the revolution is actually the West. I mean, if you think about what the British Empire's policy towards the West was before the revolution and what it was after, it's almost a complete 180. The British Empire is trying to maintain peace. They're trying to create a clear line between Indian country and colonial settlements. They want an open road to Indian country. And what do Smith and others do when they take control of the government? You know, it's kind of an unfettered expansion, a series of Indian wars. The British Empire is really completely overturned in the West, and their policy is as well. Whereas in the East, you know, the leaders in the East were still the leaders in the East afterwards. And there isn't that type of fundamental change in policy that I think you see in the West.
I want to ask one question about methodology before we begin to wrap up here, because you wrote this book in a pretty interesting way. It's very much an exercise in storytelling. All historians are storytellers, but this book really, it reads almost like historical fiction, but of course it's not. It's history. It's rooted in very deep primary source research. It's a very accessible read in that way, particularly the dialogue. I mean, I really flew through this book reading it myself. I finished it in practically no time. And you talk about this a bit toward the end of the book, where you say that you hope that this book might start a conversation about how we write history. So what do you do differently in this book? And what do you see as the limitations of more traditional academic history writing? What were you trying to correct in that sort of writing?
Yeah, so I was actually inspired to write the book, especially the way that I did, by teaching my students at Williams College, where they were always willing to read. And they really wanted a book that was accessible, relatively short, but still made a point. And what I had with the Black Boys Rebellion was this incredible primary source base to work from. There are so many depositions, so much reporting, this largely manuscripts. I mean, the interesting thing about the Black Boys is this is a massive rebellion that gets the attention of people as far as London are aware of this, and it feeds into their sense that the frontier is this anarchic place. But it's almost all in manuscript. And it's all these depositions and discussions. And I realized that I could take those depositions and without, you know, creating my own dialogue, use those as the basis for conversations that did happen historically, and really try use the sources as my guiding light, and to really get those voices centered. And so I tried to develop dialogue. Again, the dialogue is coming from the sources themselves, rather than trying to embed quotes or long quotes in paragraphs, as a way to make it read more like a novel, believing that might be able to, you know, translate the work of scholars to hopefully a wider audience. And I've been really happy. I was a little nervous. I didn't know how people would react, but the response, at least in the reviews that I've read, have been very positive, as have been all the feedback I've received anecdotally.
And one of the things that you do that I really appreciated is you play with dialogue a little bit. Maybe play with is not the right term to use, but you clean up a lot of the dialogue to just make it read more accessibly. I mean, manuscript third-person discussions of what someone said to another person, they can read in a kind of dry way. And you adjust the language just ever so slightly to make it read more like natural dialogue that real people may have had. I really appreciated that. And what kind of led you to making that particular choice? Because that was one of the most effective small changes, small choices that I thought you made in this book.
Yeah. And I don't know if I'm ever going to do it again, because I've been working on another project. And it really was the sources lent themselves to it, Stephen, because it was a deposition. And so it was simple. Like you said, it was very simple changes. For instance, if somebody's recounting a conversation and it was in the past tense, I could make it into the present tense. Or if if they were using the third person, I could make it the first person because they were recounting some other conversation they had. And it did allow me to develop better a dialogue or exchange that was recounted. Several times there were cases where James Smith would recount an exchange, and then James Grant, who is the leader of the, or Charles Grant, was the leader of Fort Loudoun. They would recount the same conversation. They basically were in agreement with what was said. So I felt comfortable adjusting that to make it feel like it was present dialogue, if you will, rather than just trying to, you can get verbose by trying to make it the dialogue work grammatically. And that's where I think sometimes you can lose readers.
Yeah, it made this book seem very cinematic, and my fingers are crossed that it gets picked up by HBO or something that can tell this story.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is was originally, this was one of John Wayne's first movies.
You talked about that. Yes.
Was something on the Black Boys, and I've often wished it would be really interesting to see how one would produce a movie that deals with these issues in the 21st century versus, you know, the much, you know, more, you know, a typical John Wayne-esque movie from the early 20th century, in which, in some ways, Wayne and the interpretation of the event was really embracing the Black boys' view of the frontier rather than taking a much more complex view of the individuals and putting it in the true context of its time, where there are these vying forces, and the colonists weren't necessarily inherently the good guys, if you will. I would love to, because then you'd have two films that were very much in dialogue with each other, interpreting the same event in two very different ways. I don't know how to do it, but it'd be fun if it could happen.
Well, that kind of gets at my next question, which is, and this is not an easy question. My guests often tell me that, but it's one that I think is important to summarize what we've been talking about here. If there's one takeaway that you hope readers come away from this book with, kind of come away from this book understanding, what might that takeaway be?
Yeah, and this is where I think I get to it in my conclusion, and that's that my view is that the politics of the West has largely been overlooked in our understanding of the American Revolution and our nation's founding. I think interest in it has waxed and waned, but you really, if you want to understand our present, you have to understand the past. And so much of the politics of what I call frontier politics of the 18th century, I think really remain embedded in our cultural DNA. You know, an incredible distrust of what are seen as distant governments who are not serving the interests of more rural Americans, a sense of a desire for government both to do more, but to also stay out of their lives. I mean, so much of our politics you can see in these 18th century moments. And so I think to really understand their roots, their origins today, you really have to go back to the American founding.
And then finally, this book came out a few years ago. It came out in 2018. Can we get a preview of what you've been working on in the interim? Do you have another project in the works?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. The pandemic has really redirected my research, my life, just like I'm sure so many others. I had decided that I had done enough with the frontier in the West and that I was going to shift my gaze across the Atlantic and take a look at London during the American Revolution. The APS, one of our great treasures, we have the 70% of the papers of Benjamin Franklin. We're kind of the chief repository of Franklin's correspondence. And I was delving into his ties with London politics and the ways in which he was aiding spies and others in London. And I was well underway on a project. And then with the closure of libraries, I had to put that on pause. And interestingly enough, I have once again shifted my gaze to the West. And I've been delving into the life of somebody named André Michaud, who was a French botanist sent to the United States in 1786 by the King of France. And he spent a little bit over a decade in the United States traveling as far south as Florida, as far north as almost the Hudson Bay, and as far west as the Mississippi River. And he is, I would argue, one of the greatest explorers of the continent until Lewis and Clark. I don't know of anybody else who quite probably covered as much ground as he did. And his story is largely untold. And the APS holds his journals. And I've been kind of using those to and explore what his life and experience in the 1780s and 90s can tell us about the early American Republic. And what's interesting is the culmination is he's involved in a plot to try and invade Spanish Louisiana. He tries to organize a group of Kentuckians led by George Rogers Clark to mobilize a militia to attack Louisiana in 1793 and seize it from Spain and create an independent republic. So even though I was thinking I was going to be moving across the Atlantic, I find myself once again sucked into these stories of the West.
That must be one of the wonderful things about working for an institution like the APS, is that you can basically close your eyes and choose a box of manuscripts at random and come across something that's worth writing an entire book about.
Yeah, well, I often joke that the vault taunts me because I find myself stuck behind my desk far too often. But interestingly, the pandemic has created this opportunity for me to delve into the sources more, and it's been so great to be able to do that. But our collection is absolutely astounding and incredible, and I hope other people that aren't familiar with it will check it out, because we just anybody that's interested in early American history, interested in the West, we have an enormous amount of material all the way up through the 19th century, material on the gold rush, on early mining. To check out our materials, I'm sure we probably have something that might be of interest.
Dr. Patrick Spiro is the librarian and the director of the American Philosophical Society's Library and Museum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His new book is Frontier Rebels: The Fight for Independence in the American West, 1765 to 1776, which came out with Norton in 2018. Thank you so much for joining me today, Patrick.
Thank you. This was great.